Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour. KPCW News Time is 8:06. Let's find out what's in store for our weather today. Here with the report, we have Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back as we go throughout your Friday, heading into the weekend. Park City, we're going to be looking at mostly cloudy skies. We're going to have a chance of scattered showers and storms developing this afternoon. Not nearly as great of coverage or chances as yesterday, but there will still be a chance of some scattered storms this afternoon. Highs only in the low 70s. We'll be in the upper 70s near 80 in the Heber Valley with partly cloudy skies and a chance of some of those scattered showers and storms developing this afternoon. As we move into your weekend, we are expecting much drier air to filter on into the area, so the chance of rain is only at about 20% for as we go throughout your Saturday. The temperatures will stay fairly comfortable. Highs in Park City only expected to be around the mid-70s as we go throughout your Saturday afternoon. We'll have those high temperatures in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, look for partly cloudy skies, mainly dry conditions, highs in the upper 70s. In Park City, we'll have those high temperatures climbing into the lower 80s as we get you over towards the Heber Valley. We'll call it low to mid 80s. And then as we get into next week, well, we're going to start to warm things back up again as we continue to remain somewhat dry to kick off the week. Monday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies. We'll have those highs in the low 80s in Park City. We'll have high temperatures climbing into the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Heading into Tuesday, we'll call it partly cloudy skies. Temperatures in the low 80s in Park City. Highs in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards your Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to introduce that slight chance of storms again across the area. Still, the jury's out on when we could see a little return of some monsoon moisture, but we'll call it a slight chance with highs in the low 80s for your middle of work week next week in Park City. And we'll be into the upper 80s for high temperatures across most of the Park City area. So, again, overall, we're going to be looking at temperatures staying seasonal levels, if not a little below average, with drier conditions after today. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to speak with Riley Pilgrim of the Unified Fire Authority. We're going to be talking about wildfire fighting techniques, a topic that seems pretty germane given what we got going on. Then Diego Zagara from the Park City Council member will stop by with a recap of last night's Park City Council meeting. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Maddie Orrett of the Kempsey Gardner Institute about how data centers interact with the Utah's truth and taxation lawyers and affect property truth and taxation law and affect property taxes. Stay tuned. The Park City School District has been ordered to stop work on part of the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the district and the city are now working together to restart construction.
The Park City School District received a stop work order Thursday to halt construction on the North 40 property. The district told KPCW in a statement that it was doing preparatory work to install shot put, javelin, and discus facilities. The track and field events were previously by the Dozier football field, but that field was reoriented to accommodate a building with concessions, a press room, and locker rooms. With no space for the track and field events, the district said it pivoted and plans to host the sports at the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex next to McPollen Elementary. The district said the proposed layout does not feature permanent structures, just concrete throw circles and removable netting. Park City told KPCW its code compliance and planning teams reviewed the activity after a resident complaint. The teams determined additional review is needed to determine whether the work is allowed under the district's conditional use permit. The city and district are now working together to decide if updates to the permit are needed before construction continues. The stop work order applies only to the North 40 field area. Other approved construction on the site can continue. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Residents of a small Wasatch County town are seeking to disincorporate, that is, to dissolve the town. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the latest from Independence.
Some residents of Independence now want to be free of their status as a town. About a third of the town's 75 registered voters submitted a petition to disincorporate to the Wasatch County Clerk Auditor's Office in late July. The move came as a surprise to Town Administrator Jody Hoffman, who's been at the helm since Independence was established in 2008. The disincorporation petition doesn't explain why the 23 residents who signed no longer want to be a town. Hoffman says their concerns may include growth pressures around the Heber Valley. Once the clerk's office verified the signatures, it submitted the petition to 4th District Judge Jennifer Mabee for review. She must determine whether the disincorporation measure can go to a vote. If it can, the court will set a date for the election within 60 to 90 days. If a majority of voters support disincorporation, independence would then dissolve. The town council will meet at the Wasatch County Senior Center at 7 p.m. August 19th to discuss the disincorporation petition. Hoffman invites any interested residents to attend. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the Rocky Canyon fire has certainly brought to the attention of our listening audience. The fire continues to burn. Some 15,000 acres were involved as of Wednesday. Not sure where it is this morning. What are the tools being used to fight the fire? And how do they differ from the techniques to use to fight urban fires? On the phone to discuss wildfire techniques is Riley Pilgrim of the Unified Fire Authority. Good morning, Riley. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Riley, what are the basic tools used to fight wildfires, and how do they differ from those used in the urban setting?
Well, we definitely are limited sometimes in what we have available to us. Obviously, especially through Rocky Canyon Fire, we're kind of more remote areas sometimes. Terrain makes it difficult to access it like we would a normal urban fire. So a lot of times we're fighting those fires on foot with just hand tools like axes and Pulaskis, shovels, helicopters, right? We rely heavily on helicopters. Sometimes we need to use road systems and trails that actually put fire on the ground to create a buffer. But it's definitely, you're limited on what you can do, and then you're obviously combating weather and topography and right now the fuel conditions, which have been pretty dry for this summer.
You know, Riley, I should have asked first, just to give our listeners a sense of who you are. Tell us a little about your background in the firefighting arena.
Yeah, so I work for Unified Fire Authority as a battalion chief, but my career really is rooted in wildland fire. I started doing that in 2001, worked on hand crews for about 10 or 12 years of that time frame, engines, worked with aviation, and now, you know, as an urban and wildland firefighter, I kind of see the extremes on both sides of the coin there with wildland fire and the stuff we deal with in the city. So that's kind of my background, but a lot of time on the fire line for sure.
And we're going to talk about what it's like on the fire line. But first, let me ask you this question. A fire breaks out, you get a report. Talk about sort of, take us inside the room where people are thinking about what to do. How do you organize and deploy resources?
Yeah, and luckily on the wildland side, just with like structure fire, we have what we call run cards or predetermined resources for geographical areas. So when we get a fire in a certain place, we already have a set basically dispatch order for fire engines and aviation, both helicopters and retardant planes. And those will go out the door as quickly as possible. And sometimes all we need is just a general location and we can locate it from there. But a lot of times behind the scenes, there's also a lot of coordination going on between the structural and wildland side of things. And then with these types of fires, we have multi-jurisdiction, multi-agencies. So between the state of Utah, perhaps the Forest Service, the BLM, the local government, you know, the city or that municipality. There's a lot of kind of inner workings going on there to make sure it doesn't matter whose boundary or whose area it's in, we get the right stuff there as quick as possible. And then obviously with the kind of the drought and the dryness and the heat we've had over the last few weeks, we've kind of enhanced our awareness and alert level, and we're going to get stuff there as quick as we possibly can, knowing that when we get fires, when we've had the conditions we've had, they're going to be pretty difficult to contain.
And, you know, when you talk about sort of resources from multiple jurisdictions, there has to have been sort of, relationships created in advance. There has to be sort of a relationship built so that you can call people in. Are there meetings throughout the year sort of to lay out how you guys will work together in the event of an emergency?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time, especially preseason, so from January to April, making sure we have agreements in place. We've done interagency trainings. The unique thing about this is when I showed up, there were people there that I've known for 20-plus years, and I came out of Salt Lake County, right, and it was really a kind of a phone-a-friend to get the ball rolling, to get additional resources there. And then once we hear there's a need, sometimes at that informal level, I pass it up my chain of command, and we exercise the actual mechanism to get stuff there under the agreements. But sometimes it's just a quick phone call to a friend saying, hey, heads up, we got our hands full over here. We need some help, and we're going to ask to have you guys come out here. And that way it gives us a chance to get our firefighters kind of geared up and ready to go. And then it gives our overhead and our supervisors a chance to just check all their boxes, make sure we're not leaving any other areas uncovered, and then we head out there to support. So, yeah, a lot of these are agreements and relationships that have literally been years, if not decades, in the making.
You know, it sounds like there's really two levels of what's going on. There sounds like there's some kind of formal agreements going on, but as a practical matter, it sounds like there's informal the web of informal relationship among the Corps of firefighters that really allow you to move quickly.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I really love about fighting fire here in Utah is we kind of can cut a lot of the red tape out of it and the bureaucracy and the wait kind of thing. And yep. We can call people and we can get stuff going as quick as possible and figure out some of the details afterwards. But luckily, these agreements that we talked about earlier that are already in place help address those details. So the firefighters can really just focus on fighting fire, and our managers and overhead can kind of deal with the administrative stuff behind the scenes.
Now, when you have multiple jurisdictions fighting a fire, and by the way, do you have a sense of how many jurisdictions are involved in the Rocky Mount fire?
Oh, boy. You know what? That's a great question. When I showed up on that fire from Salt Lake County, I bet I saw easily 15 to 20 other entities that are municipal resources that do wildland as well, on top of the state, the Forest Service, and the BLM, who are already there. So, that was an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation, and easily 20, 25 different agencies were there.
And when you've got that many agencies, I'm envisioning, obviously, people of goodwill trying to help. How do you organize command and control over that many disparate groups?
Oh, man, that's a great question. And sometimes that's actually one of the most challenging things that, as an incident commander myself, I have to wrap my head around and figure out what I got. But what's kind of unique, especially about this, is most of us understand our roles and responsibilities before we even get there. We're ordered up as a very specific, to provide a very specific service. And when we get there, we tie in with a line supervisor or somebody who's already on scene. They give us some basic instructions. We check in with that person. We go out there and start doing our job. So sometimes there's some hurry up and wait. What we joke about, where it's like, you know, we're in a big rush to get there, but then all of a sudden they're not quite sure what they want to do with us. But a lot of times we just know as soon as we show up kind of what we're going to be asked to do, and we just get after it. So a lot of it, again, goes back to training and coordination before the season. But I'll be honest, there's times here where it's pretty chaotic. There's a lot of stuff coming at you. It's a very dynamic and complex environment where things literally seem to be changing every minute. And that adds some confusion and complexity, but we just have some safety protocols we fall back on. And that's our number one priority, is our public and firefighter safety. And yeah, we always make sure that's addressed before we do anything.
Does there tend to be one person who has overall sort of supervision of the firefighting effort? I watched a movie over the weekend about watching Eisenhower and D-Day, and I'm sort of having visions of, is there typically an Eisenhower-like figure that sort of helps set priorities?
Yes. So every single fire we go on, whether it's 1 acre or 15,000 acres or 100,000 acres, we have an incident commander. And that one person has overall authority and kind of say over what happens on these incidents. They're also in coordination with the agency administrators or the landowners or, you know, the people who are responsible for the fire. And then below that, we actually have delegated positions of authority and responsibility and supervision. And every firefighter on the line knows who their boss is or who their supervisor is. And that's how we kind of maintain some order amongst chaos.
But undoubtedly, there's still a lot of chaos. I want to talk about aircraft. You talked a little bit about sort of the hand tools and the people on the ground using axes and shovels. Tell us about the role of aircraft, and when do you deploy it, and how does the retardant work?
So aircraft are definitely a vital asset, and they do things that we can't do on the ground, obviously, and they can definitely take on more, you know, they as we saw, even unfortunately in southern Utah just recently, right? A lot of aviation stuff is probably one of the highest risk things we do, and those pilots really do an amazing job, and they put themselves in that aircraft at extreme risk every time they fly. And that's not lost on us as firefighters, and I think it's something that's really important to remember, is a lot of times people wonder why we are or aren't using aircraft, and sometimes it's a safety thing. But we look at the terrain, we look at the fire behavior. There are areas where we aren't supposed to use retardant because there's a watershed or, you know, we're riparian areas or areas that are sensitive to retardant. So we try to avoid those. But a lot of times what retardant will do is it'll slow the progress of the fire until we can get hand crews in there to follow it up with either hand line or double checking things. And so a lot of times that retardant's basically a check line. It kind of keeps things in check and hopefully buys us enough time to get boots on the ground to follow up with retardant. But I can't emphasize A, our appreciation for our pilots, and B, just they do take an unordinary and extreme risk every time they fly, and that's not lost on us. And I think that's something that's really important to remember, is just how dangerous of a job they have, as well as all firefighters, but especially our pilots.
And what's it made of? What kind of liquid are you shooting?
You know, there's a lot of different things that go under retardant, but, you know, and I can't get into the exact specifics of it, cause even I don't know 100%, but basically it's, and they've formulated over the years to be even more effective. I guess the best way to explain it is, depending on the fuel type we're working in, that retardant has the ability to either penetrate down to the kind of the surface level, mm-hmm. or be a little bit thicker in application for timber and things like that, where it may not get to the bottom, but it's designed to really slow down. It's not designed to put out the fire. It's designed to impede the progress and slow it down so we have a chance to get after it. But it definitely has some chemical compounds and things in it that are not really great for waterways and wildlife and those things. So that's why we try to avoid that, is, you know, we've definitely seen it happen where retardant's inadvertently been dropped parallel to or across a creek or a body of water, and it can be catastrophic sometimes for the wildlife. And so it's kind of picking the evils of what the fire is going to do or what the retardant might do, and we make those decisions pretty regularly.
Now we hear the term backburning. Can you explain what that is and when it's used?
Yeah, and so what we typically do, and it's very coordinated, and there is some risk to it every time we use fire, but a lot of times when we have these massive fires that are super intense, they're too dangerous to go direct on, which is right on the fire's edge, and they're moving pretty quickly. Sometimes the best way to fight fire is with fire. And what I mean by that is, we'll find a pretty robust line, like a roadway or a river or some kind of feature, where we can actually put fire on the ground in a very coordinated and orchestrated effort. And basically we remove the fuel from the fire. So our fire we put on the ground will typically burn all the fuel, mm-hmm. against that road or whatever, and that removes a lot of times the head of steam that those wildfires tend to get. And those two fires, the fire we set merges sometimes with the main fire, and sometimes that's the most effective way to prevent a huge, you know, wall of fire, for lack of better terms, coming at you with full intensity and just standing there with, you know, fire engines and a couple of firefighters trying to hold it. So if we can remove the fuel from the fire, sometimes that's our best chance of stopping fires that big.
Now, how does that relate to the concept of a fire line? What is a fire line?
So fire line is, for us, it's anything that we take down to basically mineral soil. So with hand tools or dozers, we basically cut line down to the dirt, and that removes or breaks up the fuel continuity. You know, the how tight the fuels are, and sometimes that's how we stop and blow these fires. If we can use a roadway or a river or something, a natural barrier, like a area that doesn't have a lot of fuel in it, open space, we try to connect the dots with our fire line. But we're basically just trying to remove fuel from the fire, whether that's by digging it, you know, removing it by hand, or using fire to get rid of it. You know, that's what that fire line really is.
You know, another term we hear a lot is containment. And we hear, you know, what does it mean that a fire is 50% contained? And can you help the public understand what does that mean? What does 50% contained mean?
Yeah, and so containment can be tricky for a lot of reasons. And sometimes you'll see 0%, 0%, or it stays at 40% for a while. And so containment is basically fire line that we just talked about that's around the fire's edge. And it's important to remember that even though we might have, you know, part of the fire contained, the other part's still growing. And so, you know, we might stay at 40% containment because we have just one section contained and we're still making incremental progress, but it's still growing in the open areas that aren't contained. And so sometimes we like to be conservative. We definitely are mindful of our containment because sometimes it can give a false impression that we're getting a handle on something or we're not. And so it's kind of a tricky metric that we use, but we basically will take a GPS measurement of the fire where we have effective hand line that's been secured. So there's really minimal threat to that line. And that's what we started calling contained. And so when a fire is 100% contained, that means we have reliable fire line around the entire fire, but that doesn't mean the fire's out. That just means we've gotten secure line around the whole thing. And under most circumstances, it's not going to get any bigger. There's always potential it could spot or something could flare up in interior. And then we're continuing to work on that as we contain the fire, but containment is typically just the amount of line that we feel confident about around the fire's edge.
So again, thinking about a circle of a fire, if it's 50% contained, I understand is half of that circle would be stopped by a fire line.
Yes.
Right. And the rest you still have to deal with.
Correct. And if it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right, the more acres we add, there's possibility our containment can actually shrink a little bit because we've added a lot more perimeter to that fire. So, you know, for 10 acres and 50% contained, then we can reliably say, you know, 5 of those acres are probably handled. But if it grows 30 acres in a day, then obviously our containment percentage will go down a bit. So,
Riley, before we go, what would you tell our listeners that they can do to help prevent wildfires?
Well, that's the first thing is do everything you possibly can to prevent them. You know, when they have restrictions in place, please obey those and follow those. I know depending on where you live in the state, fireworks is a pretty hot topic. And fortunately, we're past that part of our season. But honestly, with the drought conditions and with how dry things are, that it's concerning. It's concerning to firefighters. And every little thing we can do to prevent creating fire is really helpful to us and obviously to the environment. But just being mindful of what you're doing when you're out working in the yard, or out working in kind of these wildland interface areas, that you're mindful of anything that could create a spark or create a heat. You know, sometimes people inadvertently start fires just trimming the edges of their yard, right? And they have a metal blade on their weed eater and it hits a sidewalk or a rock, throws off a couple of sparks into the grass, and the next thing you know, we have a fire. Parking your car in hot grass, using an ATV without spark arrestors, or you know, just different things like that where they're innocent day in, day out activities that we can normally do when conditions aren't so volatile. Those are the kind of things we need people to be just extra aware of. And then obviously call 911 at any time you see something or whatever. The sooner we can get resources there, the better. So.
Okay, Riley Pilgrim, South Lake Unified Fire. Thanks for spending time.
Oh, you're good. Unified Fire. Yep, you're good. Thank you.
Recent rain has helped crews partially contain the Rocky Canyon fire, burning west of Hennifer and north of East Canyon Reservoir.
This won't put the fire out. It's going to help immensely. The moisture will cool areas where there wasn't a lot of vegetation and maybe just a few hot spots. But we likely, as soon as this rain moves out, will start to see some of those smokes and flame up on the top of that ridge where the fire's been active.
That's Sierra Hellstrom, the spokesperson for fire crews. She says the fire is still burning hot on the ridge northwest of Hennifer, and that can cause recent moisture to evaporate. That area's steep terrain has been a challenge for firefighters. They told Hennifer locals at a community meeting Tuesday that hotshot crews would be deploying the following morning. Hotshots are hand crews trained to work in the most dangerous fire conditions. Hellstrom says there are now close to 300 firefighters working the Rocky Canyon fire. The moisture helps in some ways, but also presents new safety concerns for fire crews. Burn scars increase risk for flash floods and rock slides. Morgan County Emergency Management said on Facebook it was preparing for potential flooding along State Route 66 Thursday. It's distributing free sandbags at the county shed near 380 North Industrial Drive.
Have to be really strategic on this fire, especially as it moved up into the cliffs and those rocky areas. It's really difficult to access, and it's not easy to go direct when you've got, you know, 40-foot, 50-foot flame lengths, even during rain. So we're trying to do it safely, but using a lot of tactics between dozer and aircraft, and honestly, boots on the ground is what really gets fires out.
Temperatures are expected to pick up again over the next few days. The latest updates on the Rocky Canyon fire are available at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Park City Council had a regular meeting last night. Here to tell us about what happened, we have Councilmember Diego Zagar. Good morning, Diego.
Good morning, Roger. How's it going?
Let's try again.
Good morning, Roger.
I'm doing something wrong here.
Change mics,
yep.
How about this
one? There we go. Now we're doing one. Okay. I know that the concept of an emergency operations center was on the agenda. What would such a center look like?
Oh, that's a great question. So Chief of Police Wade Carpenter yesterday visited with us to talk about this opportunity ahead of the Olympics in 2034. And given some of the large-scale events our community will see, has seen, continues to see over the years, what would it look like if we had a centralized area for law enforcement and emergency operations to take place? And it would be more than local. This would be a regional effort, which we are seeing right now with good eyes. It's still very early days in conversation. Chief referred to the fire that took place up at Parley's Canyon a few years ago and how operations really took over the fields and the ice arena. This would serve as an opportunity for emergency response of all kinds, whether it's a wildfire or a large-scale event.
And I take it would be sort of an interagency, interjurisdictional thing. So obviously you're just at the beginning of talking about it. It would have to be a pretty substantial organizational effort. I do have this vision of these scenes in the movies where you have this room with, you know, 19, you know, screens and people like that. It sounds like it would be something like that, right, to be able to coordinate these various jurisdictions.
I also envision those movies, Roger. Thank you. I'm thinking more Minority Report with those invisible screens. I think that whatever ends up happening, you're right, it will be a multi-jurisdiction, multi-agency effort. It will require collaboration, and I'm looking forward to what plans for that can be and for us to continue investing in the safety and security of our community.
You know, given the kind of security threats we see at events surrounding the Olympics, I can understand why it might make sense and why now might be the time. If you're going to do it, you got to get started.
Yeah, yes, this is the time. I mean, we're what, 7.5 years out from the Olympics? It's going to fly by, especially for some of these large infrastructure projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Little Kate was on the agenda once again. Are we getting near the end of this discussion? First of all, let's remind the listeners of what the issue being presented on the Little Kate situation is.
Yeah, over the last, I want to say, a couple of years, the team has looked at connectivity, increasing walkability, safety for pedestrian, bikers, and a way to slow down traffic on the Little Kate pathway. It's also a pathway that families use to go to school. So lots of community feedback has gone into this, and we've seen multiple iterations of what this could look like. Yesterday was a discussion around a further go-ahead to start designing that. There's still lots of community feedback coming. Once the project hits 60 or 70%, don't quote me on the number, but it's right around there. And we're looking at what are the measures that we think fit in the neighborhood, will meet our goals around safety and connectivity and increase mobility in our town that isn't just on cars.
So just big picture, and again, this is radio, so you got to try to create a vision. What is sort of the concept that is being put forward at this point?
Thank you, yeah. We're looking at a sidewalk. We're looking at a bike pathway that's protected from cars, from vehicles, then a roadway for cars, And at this point, we're also considering other slowdown measures. We haven't seen a final design, but there was discussion around jutted sidewalks that narrow the roadway and make you slow down. And then on the other side, another path for bikes.
Okay, and was that the direction given to go ahead and design something like that?
So no, yes. Okay.
And when do you think you'll hear, when you think you'll hear back, and when will we actually see something get done, would you expect?
I want to say it's in the next few months. I think okay. this by end of year, I believe we're going to see something.
You heard a report on transportation demand management. I want to talk about that. What were the results? What did you take from that? I know that they talked about the Ride on Winter Rewards program and the regional van pool pilot program. What did you learn
about the transportation?
Yeah.
We can always do better. I think our team is looking at how to improve transit, how to create efficiencies in town. It's a good time to give a shout out to everyone that took transit last weekend to the Kimball Arts Fest. And I saw ridership was strong. I think our team is, you know, one thing that is that adds a bit of a complexity, but I see it working well, is that we have two systems here mm-hmm. with High Valley and Park City Transit, and they're working well, addressing needs of the community. So overall, I think we're in a good place.
So I actually looked at the sales tax report, which is kind of scary.
I'm sorry, I misheard. You said sales tax report.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. Pardon me.
No, that's the next question.
Okay.
We talked about transportation. Now we're moving into the sales tax report. I looked at the sales tax report, tried to understand it, but it looked to me as though there were significantly declining sales tax receipts over time. What does that mean for what are the potential implications of that for our budgeting process?
Oh, yeah. So let me open with the headline, which is the city is still in a strong fiscal position moving forward. We are seeing some economic trends impact Main Street. We saw this slow winter, but what we're seeing now, I think, is a story of recovery. We're seeing a bump over the summer in visitation. I think we are going to go into a strong winter. One thing that was mentioned yesterday was, too, that the report was there's a small lag.
There's unevenness. I guess my understanding is there's bumpiness between when the sales transaction happens and when it gets reported, and so it's not a smooth curve.
Right. So I'm very understanding of those reports and how it comes in, but I'm still optimistic about our community bouncing back, sales revenue leveling off or increasing, more events coming in that could help for that. This weekend is a great example of something that's happening in town. I was out last night on Main Street and I saw a lot of foot traffic. Chef's Table is in town, as you know, and that is great news. So again, I want to repeat the headline that the city is still in a strong fiscal position.
But if we see declining sales, I guess when does it become alarming? Well, you know, what is the trend line that we have to worry about? Even if we're not there yet. I mean, some of those numbers, and again, you know, you're comparing year to year, and those look like significant decreases to me.
No, that's a good question. I think for us as elected officials, our job is to work with the community, work with the businesses on Main Street, work with our economic development department, and look at what's ahead of us. For example, Deer Valley East, Base of Canyons. And the question for us is, how do we invest in the experience of Park City?
To get people to spend money here.
To get people to come, spend time here, and spend money here. How does Main Street look like? And, you know, I'm interested in having that conversation around what kind of investments we can make at the local level to make the Main Street experience more robust.
We all got a fault. I was sitting in the hot tub last Sunday, and all of a sudden my phone went off and told me that I needed to evacuate immediately. I considered just staying in the hot tub, but obviously it was a false alarm. Diego, is the city looking into how this happened with an eye toward preventing a repeat?
Yeah, and were you tuning in when Adam was here on Wednesday?
Yes.
I think that the takeaway is there's some silver linings here. It prompted the question for folks, are we ready and are we prepared? And these things can happen. There's tech errors, you know, that are, it can happen anywhere. It happened to our partners, but we are very understanding of those things. And just to quote Adam, it's less about who pushed the button and more about what is it, how do we make it so that this doesn't happen next go around. It's an opportunity for us to test our systems and make sure that they're working when Park City is impacted, when different parts of the county are affected, that those messages are going out to the people that need to hear it.
I know that there was a little bit of public input last night on the five-acre parcel. My understanding is that there were, you heard from for about an hour about that. Diego, I know that the More Park, Less City people presented a book of all the signatures they'd collected, and it was something like 2,400 signatures, and they're saying 2,400 signatures, some 1,600 were within the 84060 zip code. How is this? That's a lot of people. And, you know, I know you pride yourself on listening to the community. What's your reaction to all this? So how is it affecting your thinking about what ought to happen on the five-acre parcel?
Certainly. So, first of all, it's great that we have so many engaged community members, from seniors to students at McPolin being part of the signature, the petition.
Gathering, yeah.
What I would say is that this is still an ongoing process, and the feedback helps us shape our perspectives on what is the best possible public benefit from that we can get from this parcel. The process, as you know, is still in Planning Commission, and it's coming back on August 26, I believe. But I'd say that the public feedback is useful. It helps us shape our position. And at the end of the day, we're going to try and strike this balance between public feedback, the vision that that folks ran on, and the values that we hold as a community. My interests continue to lie in vibrancy, livability, connectivity, and creating these third spaces where people can come together, placemaking, so to speak. So, yeah, you're right. We did hear from a lot of folks last night, and it was great to have them there. And I look forward to continuing the conversation. I'll invite folks to reach out to me as well.
You know, I had Tana on a couple of weeks ago, and she invited people to contact her directly if they wanted to talk about this. Have you had a number of constituents reach out to you directly to talk about it?
Yeah, certainly. There's some folks that have reached out to chat with me, and it's always a great conversation. I think it's a matter of storytelling as well, and I think I could have done a better job over the last few months at telling the story
Why we got to where we got to,
yeah,
in terms of your,
yeah,
perspective.
Absolutely. So I think there's always room for improvement, and that's one area I want to work on, and I continue to encourage folks to reach out. Every council member reads those emails and takes them to heart.
Has there been discussion, you know, about the contractual implications with Brinshore if this design were to substantially change? I mean, I know there's a contract with Inshore. What happens if you mess with it?
Yeah, there's a contract, but I think for me, the question is, there's an exclusive negotiating agreement until the end of the year. And
okay,
the question is, what happens at Planning Commission on the 26th? Our role after that, whatever happens, is to think about how do we continue having this conversation, what comes into that parcel, and I see still opportunity for that process to evolve.
Okay, Diego, anything you want to add before we go? Do you get to go to Chef's Table?
Not yet. Not yet. But I'm excited that it's happening this weekend. Again, encouraging everyone to take transit. I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to our firefighters working diligently.
Yes, we're still working. Yep.
on that fire. And encouraging folks to be ready for next week, as there might be some more traffic impacts with back to school.
Yeah. Diego Zagara, thanks for spending time with me this morning.
Thank you, Roger. Happy Friday.
Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter. Well, anybody who's watched the news at all in the last few months has heard a lot about data centers. Much of the conversation has centered around environmental impacts. But, you know, major data centers can have a substantial and in some ways rather surprising impact on local property taxes here in Utah. Here to help us understand the issues, we have Maddie Orrett. She's the Director of Public Finance Research at the Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute. Morning, Maddie.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay. Data centers tend to involve these enormous amounts of land, buildings, and extremely valuable equipment. Let's start with the land and the structure. What's likely to happen? I build a big data center in the middle of a county. What's going to happen to local property tax revenues with respect to the land and building when a new data center is constructed?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we should back up a little bit and just talk about Utah's
truth
property tax system. Yeah, truth and taxation. So in general, with a couple of exceptions, we have what we would consider a revenue neutral property tax system. So as property values go up, the certified tax rate drops. So essentially, taxing entities are only allowed to collect the same amount of revenue in a given year that they collected the previous year in property tax, with a couple of exceptions. One of those is if they go through the truth in taxation process, they actually raise their tax rate to generate more revenue.
Always controversial when they do that,
exactly,
but they do that.
Exactly. And you know, some taxing entities are going to try to put that off because then they have to have public hearings and it turns into a whole thing. But anyway, so they can go through that process to raise the rate, or they can get new revenue with what's called new growth. So backing up again, a little bit more context, we tend to think of property in two buckets. We think of real property, personal property. So you're asking about real property. That's the actual structure. So when a new building is built, the taxing entity can apply the certified rate to the value of that new building and get new revenue. And the thinking there is, as there's new construction, new property, a taxing entity is going to need more revenue to provide services to that structure. So that's why they're able to generate new revenue on those structures.
So that gets them out of what I think of as the zero-sum game, right?
Which is
if, in fact, you can say, hey, this is new, I don't have to change the rate, but I can get more revenue.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So generally we have this balance where property values go up, the rates drop, but if there's new property, they can generate new revenue. So when we think about a data center, again, those two components of property, there's the real property, which is the structure. If you think about a data center, it's really just a big warehouse.
It's a big empty shell, basically.
Yeah,
isn't
exactly.
It?
Yeah. So it's not super high value, but for whatever that value is, the taxing entity can apply the certified rate and get additional revenue. So that's not going to change property taxes for residents.
Significantly.
Right. When we're just thinking about the value of the structure.
But there's lots of valuable stuff I stick inside now,
yes,
isn't there?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of the rub. So that's what we call personal property. So that's essentially anything that's inside the structure, that's personal property. And when you think about a data center, sometimes the personal property, which is the chips, GPUs, server racks, that can be 3 to 4 times higher in value than the value of the actual structure. So here's where something wonky in our tax system comes into play. Like we were just talking about, the value of the structure can be considered new growth, so the taxing entity can actually generate more revenue from that. The value of everything inside the building doesn't count toward new growth. So the value of all of that, which can be very high with a data center, essentially just gets added to the existing tax base. And so then when we think about, again, this balance, as the value goes up, the tax rate drops. If we're adding a ton of value because of all these high value chips and GPUs and everything, that then has the effect of dropping the certified rate to maintain that revenue neutrality. So that is where it actually may affect existing taxpayers, where the rate would drop as that value comes online.
We're going to repeat that because it is really complicated.
Yes.
I've got a small county in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I slap a multi-billion-dollar data center in there. Like the computers and the chips and the servers and all that infrastructure may be worth almost, you know, a significant percentage of the existing tax structure.
Yeah.
So if that happens,
yeah,
that personal property, what we call personal property,
right,
the servers and things,
yeah,
it's gonna all of a sudden be a significant percentage of the total value in that community.
Yeah.
And therefore, if the tax dollar amount being raised is constant, the rate, the real rate for all those taxpayers, mm-hmm, is going to go down and they're going to go, hooray.
Yeah, exactly. But again, getting into the wonkiness here, these high value chips and GPUs and everything depreciate relatively quickly. And so when they all come on the property tax rolls at once, and that's another nuance we can get into if they're kind of phased in, but
let's make them all go at once,
okay,
just because
so
it makes the hypothetical easier to understand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So really high value coming on the rolls at once, big drop in the certified rate, taxpayers are paying less in that year. But then because they depreciate so quickly over, they're currently categorized to depreciate on a schedule of 5 years. So the value drops, let's say we've got, $1 billion in the first year. In the second year, that's going to drop to only $620 million. So it goes down by...
Very fast.
Exactly, very fast. And so then, again, as we think about the system in balance, as the value is then decreasing, the rate is going to start creeping up to maintain that revenue neutrality. So what that means for a homeowner or a property owner, they may see a big drop in that first year, but then years 2, 3, 4, 5, that rate is going to start creeping back up. Now, I want to clarify, it doesn't mean that the rate is going to go above what they were paying before, but it's just going to create this volatility. And then if you think about year 6, the data center replaces all their high value equipment, the rate drops again. So it's tax relief in some ways, but then it's also a little bit of unpredictability and volatility due to this depreciation schedule.
And I guess another question is, it is a depreciation schedule.
Right.
And computers do advance rather quickly. Right. Computer technology does advance. But do we have any reason to believe that the actual replacement cycle is going to match the depreciation schedule? I mean, it might not, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a really significant question. When we think about how rapidly AI is advancing and we're getting bigger, better, faster chips, it could be that a data center decides to replace its chips every 3 years instead of five, which would then exacerbate the volatility for the existing taxpayers.
Is there anything that a local community could do to sort of smooth this out? I mean, are they trapped by the existing structures of the truth and taxation law?
You know, I think it's mostly how our structure is set up in statute, and ultimately the legislature has the authority to change that statute. So I really can't think of anything that local policymakers could do. I think, as we kind of alluded to before, if data centers were to phase in their equipment purchases, that would create a smoothing effect. So if, for example, a new data center were built, but only a third of it were outfitted in the first year, and then another third in the second year, that could help smooth it out. As opposed to putting all of that new value in the first year. But I really can't think of other things that local policymakers could do to help smooth that volatility for their taxpayers.
And are we likely to see, I mean, have you even looked at, hypothetically, the Box Elder development?
Yeah.
As to what, I mean, what those kinds of numbers would look like there?
We're trying to stay away from that because it's
so
a hot
controversial.
Topic.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I can say, we talked about this briefly a minute ago, is Box Elder County has a property tax base where if a giant data, a very, very high value data center were to come in, that would significantly increase the existing property tax base. And so it could create a quite significant effect for its taxpayers. So it's interesting, you know, the effect would be smoother in places that already have a large property tax base. But when you think about a large data center needing a lot of space, it seems more likely that those are going to locate in more rural counties and areas that have smaller property tax bases, which then would likely result in a more significant effect for taxpayers.
And of course, you mentioned earlier that you thought that the equipment could be 3 to 4 times the value of the building.
Right.
I would guess it could be even higher than that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about I've just got like a metal warehouse.
Right.
That's not going to be a very valuable building.
Yeah.
And I guess, I assume even HVAC, all the other ancillaries, those are all going to be depreciable assets as well.
Yeah.
So you've got not only the computer equipment, you've got all these other ancillaries that can really exacerbate. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I'll just note that we have another report coming out in a couple of weeks where we're going to delve more into tax policy around data centers, and that's going to be touching property tax, but also sales and income tax, so stay tuned for that.
Well, we may get you back to talk about
All
it
right,
with us.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks very much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
Well, as the Rocky Canyon fire continues to burn, evacuated Wasatch Back residents are turning to their neighbors for support. KPCW's Ula Brett Libre reports a Red Cross shelter in Colville is on standby.
Over 500 people evacuated the Hennifer area because of the Rocky Mountain fire burning in the mountains above the town's main street. As of Wednesday afternoon, the fire is about a quarter contained and mapped at over 15,600 acres. In response, two Utah chapters of the Red Cross set up a shelter in a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints meeting house in Colville to provide beds, food, and water to anyone in need. It closed on Wednesday, August 12th, although volunteers remain on call. Here's Salt Lake Shelter Coordinator Lynn Hurst.
We've seen no traffic come through.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of hoping, but we also heard, you know, there were a lot of people in Hannaford who they basically crossed that border and stayed.
Yeah. Summit County Emergency Manager Catherine McMullen says the lack of shelter users shows the community stepping up to the plate.
You're doing such a great job of taking care of each other that we had our Red Cross volunteers all day over at the Colville Church and they didn't see anyone, which makes me sad for them, but really impressed with you guys as a community taking care of each other.
Hurst says he was also involved in the Red Cross effort in Beaver County during the Cottonwood fire. He says no one visited that shelter either.
Utah is one of those few states that it's very, very hardy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of, okay, all right, fine, I've got to sleep on the hay bale for a night. They think of it as commonplace.
The Red Cross also partnered with the non-denominational Summit 419 Church in Colville. A spokesperson says it provides referrals to community members and connections to organizations with resources. Hurst and the other Red Cross volunteers are now, quote, on call in case of emergency. The organization can be reached at 1-800-RED-CROSS. Ulibert Libre, KPCW News.
Continuing on the subject of the fire, Utah fire crews are getting a hand from the National Guard as the wildfires here and in other states are stretching resources thin. The Utah News Dispatch reports the Utah Army National Guard is using Black Hawk military helicopters to drop water on the Wasatch Back's Rocky Canyon fire and other burns across the state. The soldiers were first called out August 5th to help slow the speed of the Black Canyon fire in San Pete County. They then shifted to Summit and Morgan counties days later, when the Rocky Canyon fire sparked. Other National Guard units across the country, including in Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, California, and Washington, have also been tapped to fight fires in the various western states.